Hey guys, as you all know, I'm always on the hunt for awesome podcasts to listen to, and I wanted to take a minute to talk about a show that I'm excited about. If you're a fan of Morbidology, then I think The Apex and The Abyss will be right up your alley. Each week, host Erica dives into each case with the sole purpose of telling the stories of the missing and those we have lost, and try to comprehend the reason behind why these crimes happen in the first place. If you like the show, make sure to check out their premium channel on Himalaya, where you can find all episodes ad-free and 24 hours early, as well as bonus exclusive content and a members-only community where you can chat with the host as well as fans of the show. Simply download the Himalaya app, search The Apex and The Abyss, and enter promo code ABYSS for your first month absolutely free. So what are you waiting for? Go and check out The Apex and The Abyss. I love the show and I know that you will too. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. The intellectually disabled are among the most vulnerable within the community. While many can lead normal lives, including holding down a job and raising a family, there are a number that sadly suffer in silence and need that extra bit of help. In an ideal world, those that struggle mentally would have a mentor or a guardian that have their very best interests at heart and assist them with their life's decisions. Sadly, for 24-year-old Vera Jo Regal from Findlay, Ohio, she was truly alone in the world. And those who appeared closest to her were in reality her number one enemy. Poverty, drugs, neglect and abuse made up the four walls of a literal house of horrors for Vera Jo, and in 2011, her disturbing death reverberated in a community which prides itself on being caring and compassionate, and led to a discussion about what could be done to better identify and assist those who may be unwilling or unable to ask for help. It was around 2 a.m. on Sunday, the 27th of March 2011, when a train operator noticed something in the middle of the tracks near the Blanchard River and the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Bridge.
They had her laying in between the tracks.
It's like, if here's the two tracks, she was in the middle. And he was going so fast with the train that he looked down and he thought that it was a baby deer.
And the engine and eight cars went over her?
He stops the train, gets out, and walks back, thinking that he was going to find the carcass of a deer. Because the train, the cars were still over her, looks under, sees that it's a human.
Initially, he had believed that the object was potentially a deer. However, upon closer inspection, he noticed that the object was the body of a young woman.
Family Police Department, please.
Hello, this is Chris with CSX Railroad.
Yes.
Hey, we just got a report that we have a train stopped over near Central Parkway, right in between there across the Blanchard River.
Okay.
We got a report that we have a train stop right now because they see a naked female body laying in the middle of the track. Appears to be deceased.
The woman was identified as 24-year-old Vera Jo Regal by an officer who identified her by sight. Vera Jo lived at 300 Center Street, just a few blocks away from where her body was found. Vera Jo Regal was born on the 11th of July, 1986, to Werner Messersmith and Willard Regal in Findlay. She was intellectually disabled and suffered from a deficit hyperactivity disorder. Before her death, Vera Jo had lived a life that was nothing short of horrific. She was just 11 years old when her father began to molest her. He was later found guilty of the sexual abuse and sentenced to 20 years at Lima's Allen Correctional Institution. Vera Jo had the mindset of an 8-year-old child, But despite her low rating and math skills, Vera Jo took special classes, and in 2005, she earned her Findlay High School diploma. Next, we will hear from Lisa Baer, Vera Jo's high school teacher.
Very shy, very reserved. I think she was the kind that if you told Vera something, she'd do it. I mean, she didn't question. Almost to the point that it was too much. I wish she could have maybe stood up for herself a little more.
To those who knew her, Vera Jo was a sweet and quiet woman who loved nothing more than singing along to country music and had participated in numerous Special Olympics events. Next, we will hear from her friend, Sarah Pugh, her cousin, Tammy Garner, and her uncle, Alan Garner.
No matter her age, Vera was still a child.
If there's a way she could do it, she would do it. You know, never complain, always help. She'd help you any way she could.
She was pretty much outgoing. I mean, she loved to sing, she liked to dance.
Loretta Lynn, Dolly Parton. She liked all the older country.
While it was initially speculated that Vera Jo may have possibly been hit by the train, her autopsy proved otherwise. Hancock County Coroner Dr. Mark Fox determined that Vera Jo had suffered from blunt force and sharp force trauma to her torso, head, and legs, and the attack had been committed at the train tracks where her body was found. As news of the murder swept across the city, a Facebook page to honour Vera Jo was set up titled Speak Out for Vera Jo Regal Messersmith, She Deserves Justice. On the page, people called for the murder to be quickly solved and urged anybody who knew anything to, quote, speak where her voice can no longer be heard. Danielle Regal Olson wrote on the page that she was Vera's cousin. She said that despite the fact that she and Vera did not speak, she was still, quote, sad that she is gone. Heather Belts, who went to school with Vera Jo, described her as a sweet girl. They wouldn't be waiting long for an arrest because just the following day, 21-year-old Daniel Bixler of Tiffin and his 17-year-old girlfriend Nicole Peters from Fostoria were arrested in connection with Vera Jo's murder. Just 3 weeks before Vera Jo's murder, Daniel had been released from prison. He had been incarcerated since July of 2008, serving time for burglary, theft, and receiving stolen property. In fact, Daniel had a lengthy history of violence and drug use, spanning his life as a juvenile and as an adult. He had prior charges of assault and domestic violence as a juvenile. One charge was assault on a 7-year-old boy with a baseball bat. Daniel and Nicole were charged with aggravated murder. Daniel was being held at the Hancock County Jail on $1 million bond, while Nicole was being held at the Hancock County Jail. At the time of her murder, Vera Jo had been living with the Brooks family, and she had been here for the past 5 years. She had a 17-month-old daughter with Zach Brooks, who they had named Willa Dean. And Zach's mother, Cherry Brooks, told the media that she looked at Vera Jo like she was one of her own daughters. Quote, she'd do anything you asked her to, said Cherry. Also living in the home was Zach's brother, Michael, and his wife, Shannon. Furthermore, around a week before Vera Jo was murdered, Daniel and Nicole had also moved into the Brooks home. Previously, Daniel had been living life as a jobless transient and consumed ecstasy, alcohol, cocaine, and marijuana on a daily basis. Now this is where it gets slightly confusing. Daniel's father, Daniel Bixler Sr., was Cherry's cousin. However, they had embarked on an incestuous relationship and Cherry gave birth to their son, Scotty.
Danny's first wife that he left for me. But she's dead now because crack exploded her heart right straight out of her body. And I'm 16, I'm already raised, so she can't do shit to me.
Scotty Emmons belongs to Danny Bixler, Sr., her mother's sister's kid. He would be her cousin.
The incest kind of stuff that's in our family.
Cherry's first 5 children, Scotty included, would be taken away from her by CPS after allegations of sexual abuse.
My sister was coming over to pick her up, wanted to take her out to her house. And the railroad tracks was right beside her house. So there was a train going by. She didn't hear my sister knocking. And she was even hollering out Cherry's name. And Cherry didn't answer. And she said when she walked in there, Cherry was supposed to be giving the baby a little baby bathtub thing there. And she was holding the baby up like this here, sucking its penis.
She's sick enough that she even molested me when I was younger.
Daniel Sr. was incarcerated himself after stabbing his wife's lover and leading police on an interstate chase. Next, We will hear from Desta Bixler, Daniel Jr.'s sister.
He tried killing my mom while she was pregnant with our younger brother, Nathan. I mean, he's just a really violent guy.
The murder stunned Vera Jo's family, and they couldn't comprehend what had led to Vera Jo being killed. Quote, "I just want to know why they decided to pick my sister. She was 24, she was kind-hearted. I just want answers. Why did they murder my sister, and why did they put her on the tracks?" questioned Vera Jo's 23-year-old sister, Ashley Messersmith.
After I found out, you know, she got murdered and everything, it broke my heart. Because me and my sister did everything together.
Quote, "She was a sweet girl, she loved everybody, and I don't know why this has happened to her. To me, she never had a mean bone in her body," said Vera Jo's mother, Berna Messersmith. Quote, "I am her mom, and I mean, you know, people need to know. More people need to speak out. If they know anything or hear anything, they need to speak out and get everyone who was a culprit for the beatings Vera took to speak out and tell everything they know. I want to thank everyone who spoke out for my daughter," she said. One of the first inquiries was to piece together Vera Jo's last moments on Earth. Investigators began the tedious task of interviewing the Brooks family, as well as Vera Jo's family. According to Ashley, the last time she had seen her sister was on Saturday afternoon, the day before her body was discovered. She said she was sitting outside the Brooks home. Quote, "I said, I love you, and she said, I love you too. She has never told me I love you. Every time I said, I love you, she just said, yeah." According to both Zach and Cherry, Vera Jo had left the Brooks home on the night of her murder with a new boyfriend. When pressed about the identity of the boyfriend, all they could say was that he was black.
When her boyfriend, what is his name? I can't even think of his name now, but it's Demetrius Jones, I think it was.
As investigators would soon come to discover, this case was far more complex than initially speculated, and life for Vera Jo inside the Brooks household was a nightmare of abuse and neglect. Due to Vera Jo's intellectual disability, she found it difficult to form relationships. When she was 19 years old, she began to technically molest Zach Brooks, who was just 13 years old at the time. However, due to her intellectual disability, Vera Jo couldn't quite comprehend that this was wrong. She herself had the capacity of an 8-year-old child. When Vera Jo's mother and stepfather moved away, Zach's mother, Cherry, said that she would take Vera Jo under her wing, and when Zach was 17 years old, he and Vera Jo had their baby girl. Cherry had a bizarre obsession with not letting her children move out of the family home. In fact, some members of the Brooks family even compared themselves to the Manson family.
Brooks family being like the Manson family, yeah, I had to agree with that. They are like that.
They're a family that makes sense, whatever she meant by that.
The Manson family.
Yes.
It's a cultish type of thing, and I really believe they saw her as an easy target.
Over the past 2 years, police had been called to the Threadbare home at least 10 times due to complaints of harassment, threats, child abuse, neglect, fighting, and poor living conditions. On the 21st of January, Vera Jo's sister, Ashley, called police and informed them that Vera Jo was being held at the Brooks home against her will and was not allowed to go outside or be involved with her baby at all.
You know, they were like keeping her away from everybody. She didn't have her friends around like she did before.
We was at the Salvation Army, and she came in with the Brookses, and she see me, and she kind of lit up, because she always smile, you know, like that, you know. And she'd come over, she put her hood up, and as she walked by, can't talk, can't talk, can't talk.
She'd stop, and I'd put my arms on her and give her a big hug and ask her where her baby was. And she said, oh, she's at home, but boy, she just run away. I mean, flat run. There wasn't no stopping and talking. And that's not Vera.
Ashley said that the only reason Vera Jo was living with the Brooks family was because she was receiving Social Security disability checks. Officer Marcia Hill responded to the report and uncovered that Cherry was Vera Jo's guardian and the payee for her disability checks. Vera Jo was routinely beaten by members of the Brooks family, particularly Cherry and Zachary.
She had to ask permission to use the restroom. I heard times that she soiled her own pants because Cherry said no.
This is a repeating day and day by day, even during like
2 o'clock in the morning.
Some days she would get lucky and, you know, nothing would happen to her.
Vera didn't get much sleep.
Officer Marsha Hill reported that officers noticed that Vera Jo's face was bruised and cut, and she had sustained a broken nose. When they questioned Vera Jo, she claimed that the injuries were caused by an ex-boyfriend from Lima. Clearly, Vera Jo had been so broken down by the abuse that she accepted what she was told to do and what she was told to say.
And he had busted her nose because she had to go out to the hospital because she had a bump here. And they said she might have a concussion and bleeding. He hit her because he got drunk and was on drugs. And I couldn't get her outside because he had been circling my house.
Next, we will hear from Wanda Smith, Vera Jo's aunt.
They come up with this story saying that Vera's had a boyfriend, a black man, that was out of Lima or somewhere, and he come up here and got in a fight and punched her in the face and broke her nose. But that's not true. It was her son, Zachary.
An ambulance was called so that Vera Jo could receive treatment for her broken nose, and the police report was sent to Children's Services. However, Vera Jo refused to provide any more information about the attack and said that she enjoyed living with the Brooks family and that she was, quote, happy here.
They came back here and told me that they talked to her, and because she was 24 years old, even though her mind was an 8-year-old mind, they couldn't do anything because she was 24 years old and she made her choice. It was her bed. She needed to lie in it.
When Vera Jo returned to the Brooks home after the hospital appointment, she received another beating. Next, we will hear from Michael Brooks, Cherry's son, and his wife, Shannon.
He came downstairs, went straight to his mom, asked her what happened, and Sherry just came up with an excuse saying that Vera was the one that pushed her own daughter into the coffee table. And Zachary just listened to what she said, went over to Vera, swung his fist, and hit her in the face. Zachary got a hold of his aunt, Sam, and when Vera didn't give her a straight answer, Samantha just straight up punched her in the face again.
Broke her nose.
And broke her nose.
When Officer Marsha Hill was questioned as to why she didn't follow up or investigate any further, she said, quote, I asked her if she thought that this environment was healthy and safe for her and Willa Dean. She stated that she thought it was. I pointed out all of the hazards I could see with just this room. She looked around the room and said that this was all she needed.
She wasn't allowed to talk unless she was told to talk by Sherry. Nobody else, just Sherry. Sherry had to be the one to tell her she could talk.
During the welfare check, Officer Marsha Hill noticed that the house was completely filthy. The bathtub was black with mold and a mattress sat on top of rotting food. In fact, there was even a pig living inside the home. It was confined to a closet by a piece of plywood, and it clearly lived inside the closet and used it as a toilet. 3 days later, police returned with a children's service worker. While here, Officer Sean Nungester reported that he had seen cockroaches in the home. The report read in part, quote, when we opened the door, a very foul smell was coming from inside the home. The house was very dirty and it did not appear that the Brooks family owned a vacuum for the carpets. Next, we will hear from Gina Lopez, who once lived in the home with Vera Jo.
I was there a few times when the cops was called. They'd come, be like, we need to speak to Vera, and Zachary and Sherry and them would tell her, don't say Zachary did anything. Or be like, you fell down the steps, you did it. It was your fault. And they'd make her do, like, just pretty much everything, and nobody else would take up and do something around the house. It was always her.
In addition to the horrific conditions inside the home and the beatings, Vera Jo was also withheld food.
There was a candy bar in the room where they had Punky's little memorial thing.
And I know Lisa Casey and Punky, they were really tight together.
I guess the candy bar was supposedly for Punky, and Vera ended up eating it because she was hungry, and they told her she couldn't get out of the room.
And Alyssa went off on her, and she actually had her on the ground, and she punched her like maybe twice.
News of Vera Jo's ordeal horrified the city of Findlay, and many questioned why something wasn't done to remove Vera Jo from the abusive environment. While Vera Jo had claimed that she was fine and safe, it was evident that she wasn't. The school system, social service agencies, healthcare providers, and law enforcement all have rules in place which they are required to follow dealing with people with mental disabilities that may potentially be suffering from mental or physical abuse. There are checks and balances built which are supposed to prevent these individuals falling through the cracks and getting lost in the system. Despite the numerous investigations, they did not result in the state providing Vera Jo protection. Next, we will hear from James Heistman, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at Siena Heights University.
That astounds me to this day, that the police did it, or even that wasn't there a social worker there. That person should have been schooled enough in knowing that that's the alpha person there. She's calling the shots. If we really want to get at the truth, we're not going to get it from her. I mean, it's just sort of police 101 that you say, I want to know what she's going to say, and I know that woman's going to get in the way, so I'm taking her somewhere else, and she's staying there. They could have done that. They could have said, no, you're not coming, you're staying there.
Following Vera Jo's death, her mother, Verna, traveled back to Findlay to arrange her funeral. As the investigation was underway, Verna spoke up about the Brooks family. She said that she and Vera Jo had become estranged and that, quote, they were talking bad to her, saying I didn't love her and I didn't want her. According to Verna, Daniel and Nicole had abused Vera Jo in the hours before her death and said that every member of the Brooks family knew all about it. Quote, nobody defended her. Nobody tried to stop it because they feared for their lives, she said. She said that there had been a long dispute between the Messersmith family and the Brooks family, and that both families had claimed Vera Jo as their own. In fact, they had even argued over Vera Jo's real name. According to Verna, Vera Jo's surname was Messersmith, but according to Cherry, her surname was Regal, which was her rapist father's name. Hancock County probate records showed that Vera Jo changed her surname to Messersmith in 2004, which was her stepfather's surname, but then changed it back to Regal in 2008. Meanwhile, Vera Jo was laid to rest at Knollcrest Gardens near Arcadia. As darkness rolled in, hundreds of people gathered at the corner where Clinton Street meets the Dr. Martin Luther King Bridge to commemorate the life of Vera Jo. They lit white candles and released purple balloons from the bridge above the railroad where Vera Jo was murdered. Just days later, Vera Jo's daughter, Willa Dean, was removed from the Brooks home. She was placed into foster care while Verna and her husband attempted to seek custody. On the 5th of April, Daniel was formally charged with aggravated murder, an unclassified felony, two counts of kidnapping, felonious assault, and tampering with evidence. If convicted, the maximum sentence Daniel could receive was life in prison without parole, while the minimum was life in prison with the possibility of parole after 20 years. Nicole was also formally charged with aggravated murder. She would be charged in Hancock County Juvenile Court, and then her case was to be bound over to Hancock County Common Pleas Court. According to the indictment, the aggravated murder charge alleged that Vera Jo was killed while the couple were attempting to kidnap her. The felonious assault charge alleged that Daniel had physically harmed Vera Jo with a knife, and then later, he allegedly altered, destroyed, or concealed the knife, which led to the tampering with evidence charge. One of the kidnapping charges alleged that Daniel had used force or threat to restrain Vera Jo with the intent to terrorize or inflict serious physical harm on her, while the second kidnapping charge alleged that Daniel, by force or threat, had restrained Vera Jo under a circumstance that caused substantial risk to serious physical harm. The next day, Nicole appeared in court for a detention hearing. Quote, I will find she is a danger to this community if released from custody, and there is a danger of her absconding from the jurisdiction, said Magistrate Kirsten Johnson, before ordering her to be taken to the Wood County Juvenile Detention Centre in Bowling Green. During the hearing, it was reported that Nicole had a lengthy juvenile record from Seneca County and had been reported missing by her mother back in March. Shortly thereafter, Daniel appeared in court and pleaded not guilty to all charges. His trial was scheduled for the 13th of June, with a pre-trial hearing scheduled for the 13th of May. Towards the end of April, court documents were filed which alleged that Daniel had raped an unidentified woman the same night that he allegedly killed Vera Jo. The woman said that throughout the night, Daniel had, quote, hinted at a murder. The woman also said that Daniel, quote, bragged throughout the night of his gang-related crimes. He said he beat anyone senseless for a ratting on him. The woman went to court to get a protection order, stating, quote, the reason why I decided to get a protection order is so in the event he were ever to be released, he would never be able to come near me again and possibly kill me. Following the revelation, Findlay Police Lieutenant Chuck Wilson confirmed that detectives were investigating the allegations made by the woman. Around the same time, Nicole appeared in Hancock County Juvenile Court, where details of the last hours of Vera Jo's life finally emerged. By this point in the investigation, it was common knowledge that Vera Jo had been tormented in the Brooks household, but it still wasn't known how exactly the murder had played out. During the court hearing, it was alleged that Vera Jo had been sexually tortured and brutally beaten by Daniel and Nicole in the Brooks home before being stripped naked in freezing temperatures and then stabbed 21 times. A number of witnesses had come forward by now to confess to police what they knew about the murder. Scotty Emmons, son of Cherry and Daniel Sr., told police that he saw Daniel and Nicole torture, beat, and stomp on Vera Jo in the hours before she was murdered.
Danny seen Zachary hit her one time, and then Nicole wanted to get involved with it. So she asked him if, she asked Cherry first, if it would be all right for her to hit Vera.
For Nicole, I guess Cherry pretty much gave her the power to control Vera.
Scotty alleged that he had tried to stop them, but they refused.
If I would have stepped up to any one of them, I wouldn't be just facing the person I would be facing. I'd be facing them all.
Scotty reported that later on in the evening, Daniel and Nicole said they were going to take a walk with Vera Jo and ordered her to put her shoes on.
And then Nicole had come in and she was standing right by Vera's door, and she's like, "You need to put your damn shoes on right now." And then Vera didn't hesitate. She put her shoes on, and I think she knew what was going to happen. I was sitting on the couch right by her room. She was looking at me for like a way out. Like, you know, she was trying to tell me to help her.
When Vera Jo asked Scotty if he would come as well, he said sure and went to get his shoes.
She knew what's going to come. That's why she asked me to come along with her.
Because, you know, she felt safe with him. And she wanted Scotty to walk with her.
But I told her, hold up, I would have to go upstairs real quick to get my shoes. Well, as I went, got upstairs, I was pretty much was stopped from leaving.
Who stopped?
I was supposed to say Danny. It wasn't. It was Zachary who stopped me.
Who told you to say Danny?
My mother. But, like I said, Zachary's the one who stopped me, not Danny. Even though I told the police it was Danny.
And why would he say that?
That, I think he already knew what was up and he wanted to protect me.
When he went to put his shoes on, however, Zachary showed him a knife and told him that he wasn't coming on the walk. Later on, only Daniel and Nicole returned to the Brooks home, and Scotty testified that he had overheard Nicole saying that she had, quote, earned her first teardrop. This was presumably in reference to a teardrop tattoo, which can indicate that the wearer had killed somebody. Daniel himself had a teardrop tattoo.
Something about, it might have been Nikki, said something, "I earned my first teardrop." I recall her saying that. But I wasn't into it because I was on my medicine, in and out, going to sleep, in and out.
Detective Matthew Tuttle also testified that Daniel had confessed to playing a part in Vera Jo's murder. According to Daniel, however, it was Nicole who first stabbed Vera Jo after she was stripped of her clothing on the train tracks. Quote, "Show me your love," Nicole then said to Daniel, allegedly while handing him the knife. Daniel said that after he was handed the knife, he stabbed Vera Jo several times before Nicole took the knife back and stabbed her once again. Daniel told police that while being murdered, Vera Jo was crying and saying that she couldn't breathe. Following the couple's arrest, Daniel had led police to the murder weapon, which was a butcher knife that they had disposed of in the Blanchard River. In addition to the eyewitnesses and the murder weapon, CCTV from a surveillance camera at the Salvation Army building across the street from the Brooks home caught Daniel, Nicole, and Vera Jo walking down towards the river. The detective's testimony touched on a potential motive for the murder. He said that Vera Jo may have been killed because somebody in the Brooks home claimed that Vera Jo had spread mace and caused a Brooks family member to have a miscarriage. Furthermore, he said that Vera Jo had looked at Daniel in a way that Nicole misinterpreted as, quote, she wanted to have sex with him or be his girlfriend.
For no darn
the only reason Nicole started it was not only because she seen Zachary, but because supposedly Vera was looking at Danny, which was her man.
Because Sherry's the one that mentioned about Vera was looking at him.
Willa Dean, I get on that day, was over close by Danny, and so Vera's like this, watching where her child was, and that's when Nicole noticed that she was gazing toward Danny, and she's like, "Oh, you want my dude, my boyfriend now?" And all hell went loose.
She got jealous and pissed off and everything, and she went off and started wailing on Vera.
There were also rumors that it was decided that Vera Jo had to die when she accidentally dropped a brick on Cherry's foot.
I asked her to come outside with me and help me clean the rabbit cage, and I had a tarp on top of the rabbit cage.
And there was like four bricks to keep the tarp on there, so that way it doesn't blow away.
She told me also that Vera had thrown big, huge rocks onto her feet, and that's why her feet had to be wrapped.
And here goes that big, big railroad track rock, and it come down, hit this foot, and what it did, it just nicked the second toe at first. And she broke my foot because this foot always goes to the side because it won't lay straight down now. Zachary come running outside, and he said, "What's wrong, Mom?" I said, "Bitch fucking dropped that rock on my foot. I need help." And he said, "What?" I said, "She fucking threw that rock on my foot, and it hurts. Get it off."
Zachary and all them, they're saying that she intentionally did it.
And I yelled at her, said, "You fucking bitch."
And Sherry was saying that she wished she would die.
I said, "You fucking hit me with the fucking rock, you fucking bitch."
The court hearing was to determine whether Nicole should stand trial as an adult. Her attorney, Christopher Travis, argued the prosecutors had not established a probable cause for the case to be transferred to adult court. He claimed that some of the witnesses against Nicole were inconsistent and self-serving because, quote, they should probably be incriminated in this matter. Due to the overwhelming evidence and brutality of the crime, juvenile judge Alan Davis ordered Nicole to stand trial as an adult. In May, Daniel's trial was pushed back to the 26th of September. The delay had been requested by his attorney, Keith Shearlow, who said that the defense needed more time to review the evidence and prepare properly for trial. There was an abundance of evidence that needed to be reviewed, and County Prosecutor Mark Miller had listed more than 60 witnesses that may be called to testify during trial. There was just no way that they could be prepared in a month, and Judge Reginald Roostern agreed and granted the request. As preparations for trial were underway, Voices for Vera hosted a bake sale at the storefront of Rent-A-Center on Plaza Drive. Vera Jo's funeral had been paid for by victims' assistance, and she still didn't have a headstone. The purpose of the bake sale was to raise enough money so that a headstone could be brought for the grave. The murder had sent shockwaves across the city, and many locals were more than satisfied to assist in any way possible. Vera Jo had lived a dire life, and it seemed so unjust for her to receive no dignity in death. With the two suspects in custody and the grim details about Vera Jo's life with the Brooks family now out in the open, many questioned why nobody in the Brooks family had been charged in relation to Vera Jo's murder. Vera Jo suffered from mental disabilities, and by all appearances, she was nothing but a cash cow to Cherry and her family. Then in mid-May, it was announced that four members of the Brooks family had been indicted on obstruction charges in connection with Vera Jo's murder. 18-year-old Zach Brooks, the father of Vera Jo's baby, was indicted on two counts of obstructing justice, while Cherry Brooks, 26-year-old Michael Brooks, who was Cherry's son, and 21-year-old Shannon Brooks, who was Michael's wife, were charged with one count each of obstructing justice. The charges alleged that the four Brooks family members had given false information to police during the murder investigation and had hindered the investigation on March the 27th, the day that Vera Jo's body was discovered. The second obstruction charge against Sack alleged that he had intimidated a juvenile witness who had gone to police with information about Vera Jo's murder. Shortly thereafter, all four pleaded not guilty, and Sherry, Michael, and Shannon were released on personal recognizance bonds, which meant that they had signed a court document agreeing to appear for future court hearings and agreeing to regularly report to the county probation department, abide to a curfew, and remain from using drugs and alcohol. Zach, on the other hand, was ordered to remain in the Hancock County Jail on $30,000 bond. His attorney, Assistant Public Defender Aaron Reed, had fought for his client to also be released on a personal recognizance bond, stating that he had no means of transport and therefore wasn't a risk to run from authorities. According to Assistant Public Defender Aaron Reed, he was also working on a case plan to try and reunite Zach with his daughter, who was in foster care. County Assistant Prosecutor Alex Trace refused, however, and ordered Zach to stay incarcerated. Meanwhile, additional charges were filed against Nicole, including two counts of kidnapping and tampering with evidence, and not long afterwards, 14-year-old Chuck Brooks was also charged with obstruction in the murder case. Chuck was the youngest son of Cherry. He denied the charge, and a prosecutor asked that he be sent to juvenile detention center, but Judge Alan Davis decided that he could continue living at home while his case proceeded. In June, Daniel Bixler pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. His attorney, Keith Gierlow, said in court documents that Daniel had taken an exam that, quote, expressed a potential limited comprehension by mental retardation and low-level IQ. Gierlow asked Judge Reginald Rouston to order that Daniel be given an evaluation to determine whether he was competent to stand trial or not. He also filed a motion requesting that the trial be moved to another county due to the publicity that was surrounding the case. Quote, the hearings regarding his specific case as well as his co-defendant's hearing have been televised and it also received extensive publicity upon the radio and in print media. Reaction to the case and other cases of the co-defendants have received extensive coverage by the media, thereby making it impossible for this defendant to obtain a fair, impartial jury trial within Hancock County. Judge Reginald Rouston subsequently issued an order that Daniel be evaluated at the Court Diagnostic and Treatment Center to determine whether he was competent to stand trial. As Daniel's evaluation was underway, Nicole's attorney, Christopher Travis, alleged that her constitutional rights were violated when investigators questioned her in regards to Vera Jo's murder. Attorney Travis claimed that Nicole had been interrogated for 31 minutes without being properly informed of her Miranda rights and to remain silent and whether she wanted to be represented by a lawyer. He claimed that when they went to 300 Center Street, where Vera Jo lived, they misled Nicole and claimed that they were simply searching for Vera Jo. Quote, detectives used trickery. They described Miss Regal as missing when they knew that she was dead and probably were aware that the defendant was implicated in the case. Attorney Travis said that following the interrogation, investigators had Nicole sign a form waiving her rights and reread a part of the form to her. When she expressed confusion, police allegedly told her to call her mother. According to Attorney Travis, this was a clear breach of Nicole's constitutional rights, and he asked Judge Reginald Rouston to exclude the statements she had made to the investigators. According to the investigators, however, Nicole was not initially considered a suspect in the murder, which was why they didn't read her Miranda rights when they first interviewed her. Detective Scott DeGraff said that while they were interviewing Nicole, they were made aware that she was a runaway and was therefore detained. He said that he tried to have Nicole sign a form acknowledging her of her Miranda rights, but she refused to sign the form. Ultimately, Judge Reginald Rouston ruled that the statements made by Nicole were admissible in court and could be used by the prosecution. In August, Zach pleaded guilty to two counts of obstructing justice and said that he would testify against Daniel and Nicole in their upcoming murder trials. In court, he admitted that he had lied to police when he told them that Vera Jo had left the Brooks home with a new boyfriend. He also admitted that within a few hours of speaking to police, he had threatened a minor's life after divulging details about Vera Jo's death and ordering the minor not to tell anybody else. With the guilty plea, Zach was sentenced to 4 years in prison for hindering the police investigation. During the sentencing phase, when asked if he wanted to make a statement, Zach said, quote, no, I'm sorry. Just the following day, Michael also pleaded guilty to one charge of obstructing justice. During his court appearance, Michael told Judge Reginald Roston that Daniel and Nicole had confessed to the murder to him and his wife. According to Michael, he said he didn't tell investigators this information because he feared for his own life. As part of his plea, Michael also agreed to testify against Daniel and Nicole. He was sentenced to 30 days in jail and 5 years of community control sanctions for misleading investigators. Next, Cherry pleaded guilty to obstructing justice. She told the judge that she knew that Vera Jo had left the home with Daniel and Nicole, yet later claimed to police that she had left the home with a new boyfriend.
And as I laid my head down, all I seen was a vision of Danny, Nicole, and Vera's purple hoodie of them walking out on outside on the porch. And I said, "Goodnight, Vera." And she said, "Goodnight." She said, "Goodnight, sugar baby." And I said, "Goodnight."
She was sentenced to 30 days in jail. However, Cherry was wheelchair bound, and Judge Reginald Roston said that her medical problems, including high blood pressure and diabetes, could inhibit her from serving the jail sentence. Just the following day, Shannon also pleaded guilty to obstructing justice. Like all the other members of the Brooks family, Shannon had told police that Vera Jo left the home that night with a new boyfriend and not Daniel and Nicole. She too was sentenced to 30 days in jail. And then finally, Chuck pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice, but due to his young age, was ordered to complete a program at the Juvenile Residential Center of Northwest Ohio in Bowling Green. In just the space of 1 week, each member of the Brooks family had changed their not guilty plea to guilty. With each confession, it became even more apparent that the Brooks family knew exactly who had killed Vera Jo and had attempted to protect them.
We don't understand. We don't know why that there was only two people that was charged with this murder. There was so many people involved, and there's only two people that's being charged with it, except for lying to the police. Wow.
Many members of the Brooks family were questioned by members of the public as to why they didn't interfere when it became apparent that Vera Jo was going to be murdered. Before being murdered, Vera Jo had been brutally beaten, and they were all present when it happened. There were more than enough people inside that home that seemingly knew what exactly was going to transpire, yet did nothing to protect Vera Jo.
I asked her a million times, "Sherry, why didn't you call? Why?
Of course, they all had their own excuses.
Like, someone's really going to be there to help me say, "Hey, go get the phone over there off of my computer stand so I can call the cops." You know, Nikki's not going to give me a phone. Dan's not going to give me the phone. Scotty sure in the world's not going to give me the phone. And Shannon, her fat ass, was sitting on the couch playing with her phone.
I wish I would have had my phone working, because it was dead and I had no minutes. And Kevin was rolling cigarettes. I wanted to use his phone, but I don't like asking him to use his phone. So I wanted to ask Zachary, but then I seen, you know, Zachary and Danny talking and laughing, and I knew, okay, Zachary gotta be behind this too.
Towards the end of August, Daniel was deemed fit to stand trial. He had been evaluated by the Court Diagnostic and Treatment Center in Toledo. However, at his attorney's request, he was ordered to have a second mental evaluation by Dr. Wayne Graves of Central Behavioral Healthcare in Toledo. Based on the second evaluation, Daniel was found competent to stand trial once again. However, during his plea hearing, Daniel pleaded guilty to aggravated murder, kidnapping, felonious assault, and tampering with evidence. He remained emotionless throughout the entire court hearing. He confessed that he, quote, "went to the tracks with Vera and I ended up stabbing her, before throwing the murder weapon in the Blanchard River." Daniel was subsequently sentenced to life in prison, without the possibility of parole, for 40 years. During the sentencing phase, Assistant Prosecutor Alex Trace divulged Vera Jo's last moments on Earth.
Vera was beaten with a belt with a padlock on it for 4 days.
Chucky's padlock from his school locker was sitting on the stand, and they just happened to pick it up and hook it to the belt. And then all of a sudden, that's when they started hitting Vera in the head and the body with it.
It was their weapon of choice after that. That and a big, long paddle with a number 3 on it.
Nicole took the paddle and beat Vera's ass, and Vera had a bruise on her ass. And all Vera had on was a t-shirt and her underwear. She had to pick up the dog poop of Jackson and eat it.
I think they said Chucky.
I'm
made
pretty
her
sure it was
eat
him.
The dog poop. You know, and Vera, she was getting sick because of it.
Well, she started throwing up, and Nicole had poured it back up like this into her mouth and was pouring her puke and all that stuff that was coming out of her mouth right back into her mouth.
Talking about they took a plunger and put it up. And
they sodomized her with it, yeah.
She was completely naked. That she was on her menstrual period that day. They took a toothbrush. They raped her sexually with the toothbrush.
And then she had to use it for her mouth.
And they thought it was funny. They thought that all of this for some ungodly reason was hilarious.
He described how following the seemingly endless hours of torture and abuse at the Brooks home, Daniel and Nicole led Vera Jo to the railroad, where they ordered her to strip naked. Once nude, Daniel stabbed Vera Jo once in the leg so that she couldn't run away. He then proceeded to stab her chest, back, and throat, almost from ear to ear. After leaving her to bleed to death, the couple returned to the Brooks home, where Daniel reportedly bragged, quote, "I killed that bitch and she's dead on the tracks."
He left her to bleed out on the railroad tracks alone, naked and in the cold. And from there, he told the detective he went to party.
They were celebrating, yeah.
They called me up and then they told me what they did. Well, I thought they were messing with me. So I walked back to their house to see if it was true.
I look at Nicole and she's got this big smile on her face, you know, and she puts her arms out like this, like she wants me to hug her. And she's like, "It's done. It's done. No more." And I was scared. And she just comes in and hugs me.
When they did come back, Danny went over to Zachary and patted him on the back.
When I go back in the living room and Danny's in there high-fiving Zachary, and then they go into Sherry's room and they're both, you know, kind of laughing.
And I got there, they were talking about how they killed her and stuff, but I didn't believe it.
Quote, "He doesn't have a sorry bone in his pathetic body," said April Walker, one of Vera Jo's cousins. Many found the guilty plea to be a slap in the face and an easy way of getting out of receiving a death sentence. Outside the courtroom, April said that there were many others, not just Daniel and Nicole, who were responsible for Vera Jo's death. She said that Vera Jo had been abused for a prolonged period inside the Brooks home, and because she had special needs, she couldn't defend herself. Yet not one person inside that household stepped up to defend her. Following Daniel's guilty plea, Nicole too pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit murder, two counts of kidnapping, and tampering with evidence. During her court appearance, Nicole confessed that she helped plan the murder and went down to the railroad tracks with Daniel, where he proceeded to stab Vera Jo. It was the first time that Nicole had acknowledged her participation in the murder, and the first time that either had admitted that the murder was planned before the trio headed to the railroad tracks. Furthermore, Nicole claimed that Zach, Cherry, Michael, and Shannon had also helped plan the murder, and Zach had provided Daniel with the murder weapon. She also said that the entire family had decided to kill Vera Jo.
"Daniel Bixler, Shannon Brooks, Zachary Brooks, Garth Brooks, Cherry Brooks, and I agreed to kill Vera Jo Regal on March 26, 2011. We agreed to do this because Shannon Brooks said Vera Jo Regal caused her to miscarry."
On the day of Vera Jo's murder, Nicole claimed that Daniel had spent hours beating and abusing Vera Jo in the Brooks home with all of the family present, and with many of them participating. According to Daniel's attorney, Keith Sherlow, the Brooks family had become frustrated with Vera Jo and said they needed something to be done about her. Quote, "They kept trying to push someone into doing this, and unfortunately, Danny, all he knew from his upbringing, from his family, from being in prison prior, was unfortunately violence." Judge Reginald Rosen sentenced Nicole to the maximum prison term of 23 years. Following her sentencing, Nicole apologized. Quote, "Vera was a very sweet, kind, enthusiastic individual who lived life to the fullest. For her to be beaten the way she was is something no one should have to be put through. I know no amount of I'm sorry will justify or bring Vera back, but this is me making amends and taking responsibility for my actions, she said. According to Vera Jo's mother, Verna, the only reason that Nicole apologized was to look good to the judge. With the startling statement from Nicole about the Brooks family being just as guilty, Vera Jo's family questioned why they got off with such a light sentence. Quote, "Why are they not in prison? Why are they not where Nikki and Danny are going?" said Vera Jo's cousin, April. The guilty pleas left more questions than answers, the main one of which was why. Why did they kill Vera Jo? Was it jealousy, revenge, unwarranted rage, or some perverse sense of family honour? Sadly, we will never know. Another question remains, and that is how an intellectually disabled woman, who is well known throughout social services, was left so vulnerable by those entrusted with protecting her. The signs were all there, but seemingly they were ignored. Some have said that Cherry was obsessed with Vera Jo and Zach's daughter, Willadine, and when Zach lost interest in Vera Jo, the Brooks family saw no need for her anymore.
Vera was like way out here. You would talk to Cherry or you'd see Cherry as, my baby's in there, my baby. That's my baby. You know, it's always my baby.
They kept on telling Willadine that Vera wasn't her mom, that Cherry was her mom.
See, I seen Cherry after Willadine was born maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 months later. You see my new baby? So that's Vera's. No, it's mine. I adopted this baby. So it was no longer Vera's. Vera never had anything, could not do anything with the baby. She touched the baby, Zach hit her. That was Sherry's baby, not Vera's.
In the wake of the verdict, Vera Jo's daughter was transferred to Children's Protective Services, where she would be placed up for adoption. From prison, Zach appealed for custody, but thankfully, he was unanimously rejected by the 3rd District Court of Appeals. The case made the community more aware about people with intellectual disabilities that live on their own. According to prosecutor Mark Miller, area agencies, police and courts now collaborate to better help those in high-risk situations that lack support from either their family or somebody with their best interests at heart. Finally, in 2013, a gravestone to mark Vera Jo's burial site was finally put in place. It had been donated by Steve Johns, the co-owner of Finley Monument Company, after watching the documentary Goodnight Sugar Babe, The Killing of Vera Jo Regal. The black gravestone features a photograph of Vera Jo alongside purple ribbons. Today, both Daniel and Nicole remain incarcerated, but every single other key player who had a role in Vera Jo's death are free.
And you're right at this time, I'd like to read a letter that was found in Vera Jo's purse after she was murdered. And this is what it says. It says, "I love you, Willadine. You are a good little baby girl to us. I'm glad to be your mommy, and I'm glad that I had you on November 4th at 4:16 a.m., 6 pounds, 2 ounces, 19 inches long. Mommy loves you."
Vera Jo Regal lived a traumatic life, and that trauma only ended with her brutal murder. The murder sent shockwaves across Finley and brought out strong emotions. Many questioned how anybody could do this to another human being, let alone one as vulnerable as Vera Jo. There is a system in place to help protect people like Vera Jo who are victims of abuse or sufferers of intellectual or physical disabilities. There are checks and balances in place to prevent individuals becoming lost in the system. But tragically, for Vera Jo, she somehow got lost and slipped right through the cracks of the system and into her grave. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to take a second to thank everybody who has joined me on Patreon or Himalaya Plus. Morbidology is a one-woman team and the support on there really does go such a long way. So if you're interested in supporting the show in return for exclusive episodes, ad-free episodes, early release episodes, and other goodies, then head on over to Patreon or Himalaya Plus. The links are in the description. I'd also like to thank everybody that has taken the time to leave a kind review or rating on iTunes or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. It truly does help out. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.